filter, you won't quite get the performance they are dictating in insertion loss, skirt selectivity, ripple in the band, and so on. Some of these parameters that are desirable will degrade if you don't have enough Q of the resonator. So in a case of a filter, the higher the Q of the resonator, the better. In the case of a tank circuit for a transmitter, there is a desirable Q region of around 10. Go below that, and you've got a pretty sloppy filter for the tank circuit, and significant harmonics are going to come out, and you might create some television interference. With a Q of 10, you have a reasonable performance along those lines. Go to a Q of 100, and all of a sudden the circulating current in your plate tank circuit is so high, you're starting to lose efficiency. You're generating heat in the plate tank circuit instead of taking that valuable RF energy and sending it up the antenna. So there is a desirable region of Q for that plate tank circuit. And on some of your microwave frequencies, which is a great big capacitor built into the tube, and you have no choice but to live with it, and you have a Q of 100 where you'd like the Q to be 10, you're going to lose a little bit more of the power in your plate tank circuit. But too much Q ain't good in that location. In the case of an antenna, the higher the Q, the more narrow the bandwidth. So in most circumstances, you want the Q of the antenna to be as low as possible. Even though we call it Q, which stands for quality factor, in the case of an antenna, the higher the Q, the more I get into trouble, because it's tuned to the wrong place compared to the signal I'm trying to transmit today. It also has high circulating current, so I'm probably wasting some of my RF energy. It's probably also with high Q on the antenna element, producing high voltages, I might get some Harkover problems. So Q of the antenna, I want it low. Q of the resonators in the filter, I want it high. Q of the plate tank circuit, I want it in a certain region. So, yeah, we can convert all of those Qs for those various applications into decibels if you like, and you'd like it to be decibels of performance. Decibels of gain of the antenna, it is not. You'd like it to be decibels of efficiency of the plate tank circuit, it is not. We'd like it to be decibels of signal that's not lost in a filter, there you're coming close. As long as I'm using the right standard for comparison, comparison, I could come up with a decibel quality factor for Q of resonators in a filter. But it's a tough one. I see where he's going. He's got a very good intention. It's a tough one to sell from what I know right now. K2KEY, give a little bit of delay in case someone wants to put in a comment on this one. K2IW, the TechNet.
Yeah, that's why I held it out. I get a whole bunch of them here. I've been most of them, but every so often I see one, you know, that, should I say, borderlines on the outrageous. So I put it aside, but you get a kick out of that one. Let me put it another one that I think is interesting to discuss. The open loop voltage gain of an operational amplifier and expressing it in dB. How does that sound, over?
There, I agree. Many of the manufacturers, Texas Instruments, why can't I think of the brand name, Burr Brown, many of the big names in op-amp analog devices will express the gain in decibels. The primary performance characteristic of an operational amplifier is voltage gain. If I had a operational amplifier where in the open loop manner with careful testing techniques, it's not easy, but with careful testing techniques, I find that if I put 1 millivolt of sine wave signal into the input at a low enough frequency where I'm getting full performance, 1 millivolt of input, and the output gives me 1 volt, that's 1,000-to-1 voltage change, and if I dumbly convert that into power, since power is a function of E squared over R, and I square the 1,000-to-1 voltage gain, I get a million. And if I convert the million to decibels, I'll come up with 120. I can buy a Burr Brown analog device or Tektronix or many other brand name operational amplifier, a 741 operational amplifier, 1970 technology, old thing. It's got 110 dB of gain. So I can buy an amplifier today easily with that amount of gain, voltage gain. Stand by a second. And here we're in a fuzzy area. If the operational amplifier is operating correctly, thoroughly open circuited, the output impedance might be in the vicinity of 1,000 or 5,000 ohms. The input impedance might be in the in the case of a FET input op amp, the input impedance could easily be 10 to 100 megohms. Huge differences in input impedances in open loop circuit configuration. Now I put a resistor network around the op amp, so I'm now really using it in the feedback manner for which it is designed. I can now make the output impedance that you will measure in a laboratory with good equipment. I can make the output impedance a small fraction of 1 ohm. So, what's the output impedance of my op amp? Well, it depends on conditions. I can make it thousands of ohms using an open loop. I can make it a small fraction of 1 ohm using a closed loop. The most extreme case is where the output impedance is a fraction of 1 ohm and the input impedance is 100 megohms. And if I dumbly forget about impedance, if I only look at voltage ratios of gain, open loop, I will call it 110 or 120 dB of gain. If I try to convert with impedance knowledge, input power and output power, I'll come up with numbers because the input impedance is so high at the input, very little power is going in. Because the output impedance is so extremely low, huge amounts of the pound power are coming out. Instead of my voltage gain being what looks like 110 or 120 dB, I'll come up with 300 dB as a number. It's preposterous. You can't use it. Because the input and output impedance is so much a function of how you use it, and there's a zillion ways I can use it. Voltage follower, inverter, non-inverter, part of a Thalen key filter network, as part of a negative emittance converter network. And there's thousands of ways I can use an op amp. As a filter bandpass, filter reject, filter notch, low-pass filter, high-pass filter, current measurer, floating source, floating current source, floating voltage source, non-floating, logarithmic amplifier, anti-logarithmic amplifier. It goes on and on and on. Oscillators, multivibrators, affable multivibrators, triangular wave generators, sawtooth wave generators, square wave generators, sine, cosine generators. It just goes on and on. There's a zillion ways I can use an op amp. For every one of those applications, I've got a brand new equivalent input impedance and a brand new equivalent output impedance. So if I start using the impedances in that circumstance, I'll go crazy. Everyone has said, I'll throw my hands up and say, the hell with it. I'll simply dumbly look at voltage because all of the equations I use for measuring stability, all the equations I use for measuring performance as a filter, as an amplifier, as an inverter, and whatever, are primarily voltage sensitive, occasionally current sensitive, and I can buy a transmittance type op amp if I want to, where current in becomes voltage out, and that's a gain phenomenon. And we measure it as mu, mu equals GMRP, transconductance, which is measuring micromohs and millimohs and mohs. It's ohm upside down. So because the impedances of op amps are all over the map, depending on what circuit, how I used it, how I configured that particular circuit, you just completely give up and say, I'm going to talk about the voltage gain, I'm going to forget about the impedance in this circumstance. This is the exception to the rule. In those decibels, you don't calculate power. In almost everything else, to make it come out right, you need to calculate input power and output power, convert that as a hard ratio, take decibels of that, multiply by 10, and now you know decibels of power gain. In the case of op-amps, we talked about decibel of gain. The unstated parameter is we're talking about decibels of dumb voltage gain, as if you know nothing about impedance and you don't give a dumb. That's one possible explanation. It's the exception to the rule, and you can see some of the reason why it's got to be that way, though. Good question, in my opinion. All of these are. K2KEY, K2RIW, and TechMan.
This is K2KEY. That's why I picked them out specifically. I had a lot of them. I can say as many of them. I just answered the silly, simple, but I saw some unusual ones. That's why I stayed. Yeah, the confusion usually is because of, you know, the voltage power question. And I guess there's, you know, the absence of a number, and, you know, of uncertainty in, when it comes to voltage power. And, of course, when the question is asked again, you know, it always comes up to DB voltage or DB power. It's, you know, the question actually has very little meaning. So it's hard, again, for me to really express that when you come up with that question asked, is it DB voltage or DB power? They're actually able to show that the question really has very little meaning. And that's basically what it comes down to. It's really the confusion, Dick, over.
QIQ with a comment.
QIQ, go right ahead.
Yeah, just I guess the way that I think about decibels, by the way, my name is Glenn, K2QIQ, my name is Glenn. It's when I think about decibels as an engineer, most of the time I think of scientific units, like with voltage on a decibel scale. Voltage is typically a specific voltage reference point for the unit. Power is a decibel point to a reference power level at the unit. When you get into ratios like gain, Q, other things like that, the units are canceled and it becomes just a ratio. At that point, decibels just almost, sometimes almost seem as if they're gibberish, but you always have to go back and be careful to make sure that all the units are in the same order.
In most amplifiers, like Glenn, if you and I were designing an RF amplifier stage, and we had something in the vicinity of 50 ohms of input, and maybe it's a constant current amplifier, and we got some weird impedance coming out, it might be the resistive component of 500 ohms. No, modern day RF transistors were producing power. The output impedance might be 9 ohms. And then we put some kind of an impedance matching network to bring it back to 50. But if we're measuring the S parameters of that transistor in a good network analyzer, the S21 will be measured with a forced source impedance of 50 ohms on the input of the device, a forced load of 50 ohms on the output, and the S21 scattering parameter forward voltage gain phenomena will be a vector of some amount of voltage gain ratio at some particular phase angle. So the real transistor in that case has an input impedance and output impedance that are far from 50 ohms, but you put it into a 50 ohm source, 50 ohm load test fixture to measure the parameter, because that is the particular definition of how you measure S21 scattering parameter, forward gain. And when you feed it backwards, you call it S12 reverse voltage transfer ratio, but a similar test procedure. So there, the real impedance in that measurement is not made, but you are forgetting about the impedance of the transistor, letting the test fixture take over when you measure the forward characteristic. But then you do measure S11, input impedance real, with the output of the transistor terminated with 50 ohms, and you also measure S22, output impedance of the transistor with the input 50 ohm terminated and properly biased. So with those four S parameter vectors, we eventually get to the bottom line of what is the device really doing. You put it into the right equation, you know what the stability criteria, gain, bandwidth product, you know everything you want to know, assuming the S parameters over the right frequency region were properly measured. So inadvertently we get there. And now we do talk about maximum achievable gain, maximum stable gain, and so on. You plug in those S parameters to the right set of equations, and you find out what is the best noise figure, best gain, maximum achievable gain, maximum stable gain for unconditional stability, and so on. You plug it into the right schematic diagram, the right formulas, and those S parameters tell us everything we want to know. So almost everybody likes to measure S11, which is really a voltage ratio. S11 really means input impedance, and you measure that by putting some standard voltage in, typically minus 10 dBm, a tenth of a milliwatt. You put a tenth of a milliwatt into the device, and you measure what reflects back toward you. And you measure what reflects in magnitude and the phase angle. That's what S11 really is. And you convert it all to voltage depending on what units you measure it in. And now, we engineers and amateurs usually temporarily forget about the phase angle. We take the magnitude of the reflection coefficient. It might be 0.1 volts for every volt you put in. A 0.1 S11 scattering parameter, input impedance, measurement technique. We convert that in voltage decibels. We say it's got a 20 dB reflection coefficient. All the engineers that are reasonably smart know what that means. We're all on the same page. We're communicating with each other. Scattering parameter, S parameter, input impedance, S11, minus 20 dB. That really means a tenth of a volt comes back for every volt that goes in. That gives you a hint as to how far it was from 50 ohms. If it was exactly 50 ohms, it would absorb all the power you put in, you'd get a reflection coefficient of zero, infinite dB, negative S11. So, again, inadvertently we're getting, left-handedly we're getting the impedance of the device when you measure the S11 input impedance. It's the same thing with the S22. So we're getting there, and we convert them into dBs. And so, in that particular case, because the test fixture always supplies a 50-ohm source, the test fixture always supplies a 50-ohm load, so the test fixture is supplying the definition of the impedances, even though the device itself could be hell and gone on its real input impedance and output impedance. Whoever designed scattering parameters, and I think it was the geniuses at Hewlett-Packard way back in the 60s, found a beautiful way of getting around these conundrums that we're sort of getting into when we talk about power dBs, voltage dBs, and current dBs. The scattering parameters sort of getting around that, and it works. And it's almost ideal. I think very few people have anything wrong with scattering parameters. And the reason scattering parameters were invented is because when I first was cutting my teeth on transistors in the late 50s, we talked about the hybrid parameters. And the hybrid parameters were measured by what output current you have with a short circuit when you pull in a known amount of current on the input. Well, you take a modern-day microwave transistor and you put a short circuit on the output and you think you're going to make a measurement, you've got one hell of an oscillator. And the same thing when you measure reverse voltage transfer characteristics, you've got an open circuit on the input. Again, you've got an oscillator. So the geniuses who come up with the scattering parameters where everything is forced to be in 50 ohms, except for a couple of rare exceptions, almost everything is stable in that environment. It's so heavily loaded, resistively. And so we don't use H parameters anymore. Oh, for audio transistors we do. A good audio transistor, you put a short circuit on it to measure the forward beta, as it's called, hybrid parameter. Usually it won't oscillate. But you do that with a microwave transistor and you're in a heap of trouble. Those are some of my opinions on that, Glenn. I wonder if you've encountered some of this jazz. KC2, QIQ, good question. K2LIW in the tech man.
Yes, I have, Dick. As a matter of fact, I used to work for microwave power devices about 10 years or so ago, and used to work on a lot of radar amplifiers, and certainly I'm quite familiar with scattering parameters. But like, as you're saying, I guess, you know, we were talking about decibel scale versus, you know, in terms of ratio as opposed to, you know, specific scientific units. And generally, you know, when I'm very comfortable talking about decibels with voltage or current in terms of power ratios or voltage, amplitude of audio, you know, then it's a specific level. But like you're saying, once you get out of that area of specific units, specific scientific units, you get into ratios where the units are canceling, you need additional fixtures like 50-ohm systems in terms of network analyzers where you can look at insertion loss, return loss, output return loss, and, you know, make those kinds of measurements. And then it's understood that everything is 50 ohms. But a lot of times, in just terms of theoretical discussion, a lot of times you have to add all of those features to it because you don't have the scientific unit in front of you on a piece of paper, so you have to say, yes, everything's going to fit in your own system, and all these other things take place. I guess that was my only point when someone was talking about Q before, and, you know, what is it? Well, it's a ratio. So when you're applying decimals to it, you have to be careful that all of your apples are in order.
I think you said that you worked for Microwave Power Devices 10 years ago. Was a man named George Flanagan, W2KRM, there at the time?
Yes, he was. He was also a Corvette enthusiast. He had a 1962 Corvette. I'm also a Corvette enthusiast myself, but yes, he did work there.
Boy, you guys, kindred spirits. You've had your current ham radio license how long, Glenn?
My current license now is about coming up to about 6 months or so. But I did have a license years ago, back in 78, 79, a technician license, and just around Christmas time or so, I just went back and renewed and got my extra.
Well done. Welcome back. Yeah, you sounded much too knowledgeable for a brand new ham. I just knew you had some previous experience. You've been there, you've done that. And I bet you worked on some of those projects with George where you're trying to produce a zillion watts on roughly 1,200 megacycles, solid state, and pouring it all into an SMA connector on the output. And these were pulse transmitters, is that true?
Yes, they were. There was also the home of OTH radar we did in there as well, you know, the low-band radar, which I had quite a bit to do with, and also doing a lot of the MIT work in the microwave lab. That was a lot of fun, but yeah, those were the good old days. KC2QIQ.
And I guess, I think MPD was acquired by MACOM. I may be wrong on that one. And I guess life got a little bit complicated after that. If you were running the company, it would still be a happy company, wouldn't it, Glenn?
Well, I guess in a perfect world, but yeah, back then, MACOM bought us out, and actually we were with them for a while, and it wasn't too bad there. It was actually the second acquisition where another company came in, a company called Charterhouse, and that was more of like they were interested in the company more in terms of assets than in terms of core business itself.
Hey, you with a Corvette, him with a Corvette, boy, what kindred spirits. George and I are going to be having a get-together. Have you ever heard any discussions with George on the subject of his spark transmitters, arc transmitters, and other high-voltage generators? I wonder if you and he have ever had a discussion on that. He's quite an enthusiast of high-voltage circuits.
Yes, I have. Granted, I haven't seen George in a long time. Actually, since I was working at Microwave Power Devices, but one time I can mention a story where we had that spark generator set up in the lab, and set it up and generating quite a few sparks there, trying to make a few measurements on it.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about that someday. I know he owns I don't think he owns a Van de Graaff generator. I think he owns a Tesla coil. He owns a Jacob's ladder circuit. And he has given demonstrations at the Ham Radio University on a couple of occasions of spark and arc transmitters. And they're exciting. Noisy. My goodness. And he's talking about hundreds of watts of spark and arc. In the days of Fayetteville, and if you go to the right website, you can see George Flanagan's recently published pictures of the Fayetteville 1916 transmitter, which ran 200 kilowatts of arc in a nitrogen atmosphere and a high magnetic field. Boy, that must have been deafening. I think if you were near that transmitter without ear protection, without radio frequency biohazard protection, I think your life was at some risk. 200, 300 or 400 kilowatts of arc transmitter. And that was required to give a reliable circuit across the Atlantic Ocean between Eastern and Western Europe and the United States. Them were the days. Come a long way since then. Okay, I know I've drifted off the subject again, Mel, but I'm going to send it back to you. K2KEY. K2RIW. Look out for those electrons.
Now, Roger, this is K2KY. That's why they called it a radio shack in those days, because the shack was where the transmitters were located, and the distance away was where the operator was. That's where they called it a radio shack. Wood building, full work. and the derivation of Radio Shack. Okay, let me just finish up on up amplifiers. That how that we got into that. We started, to simplify the last statement on up amplifiers before I forget. I made a little note so that if you look on the data, if you go to data on up amplifiers, you will find most of the data sheet, I believe, the specification will be. They will show you. I guess in volts per millivolt or volts per microvolt will show up as the open loop voltage gain of an operational amplifier. I believe that's the way it will be expressed in a chart on that particular operational amplifier. Okay?
Yes. Without a doubt, that is more scientifically accurate to do it in volts per microvolt, volts per millivolt of input. But in the old days, and in other portions of the same data sheet sometimes, it will be expressed as decibels. When you see the curve of what I call the Bode plot curve of most of the op-amps, where they express gain vertically versus frequency horizontally, it's almost always expressed in logarithmic vertical, logarithmic horizontal, horizontal logarithmic frequency, vertical logarithmic gain. Quite often, the volts per millivolt or volts per microvolt is expressed in decibels. And so, as long as everybody knows what they're talking about, it does work, even though there is some definite error, because in a pure world, gain in power, 10 times log, gain ratio, gain in voltage, 20 times log of voltage ratio, gain in current, and 20 times log of current ratio, all three of those techniques must come up with the exact same number of decibels in a pure world. But we sometimes violate the rules a little bit in order to put it into convenient units when it comes to something like an op-amp. I guarantee you can find lots of data sheets in the past that express the gain in decibels, and there's probably modern-day data sheets that are a little bit more accurate with volts per millivolt, which somewhere else might express it in decibels. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, Roger. Just want to make sure that I gave a simple answer to this, and that's why I pulled the questions out of the emails, because I thought they'd be the most interesting of them all, and what really is really true statement. Okay, I guess that sort of covers the, most of whatever I was able to get to so far on emails. I'm a little bit behind on emails. I will say it again. I just can only spend so much time with it. And after that, I've tried to answer these questions. I try not to turn anyone away, as long as it pertains to amateur radio. Again, if you're sending me things to quote on stock book, quote a stock if the company is, doing some experimental, and you've got the pamphlets they send out, as to what they're, working on or whatever, whether or not it's good to invest in the company, their perspective, I will not comment on them. I seem to get a lot of that fix, so I'm just going to, we'll just pass up on that over.
Yes, Mahu, you guys who are listening, try to go easy on Mel. He, with good intention, said that he will answer emails and he's going to try to answer them all. But in the last few weeks where he's talking about 70 and 80 emails per week, maybe Mel types at 80 words a minute. I'm a fine tech typer at 15 words a minute. It's one of the many reasons where I will not volunteer to answer email. If people have a real question and they come on this net over the last 25 years, ask that question. I'll do the best that we can to answer them. And Mel and I both have a philosophy of life. There are no dumb questions. There's only dumb answers, so to speak, or irreverent answers or unpolite answers. I think Mel and I both have the philosophy that a so-called dumb question really is the one that's most deserving of an answer. that represents the greatest gap between what the person does know and what he would like to know. We can't blame a person for lack of knowledge because he has lack of exposure up till now. That's the purpose we try to serve here. We're trying to disseminate knowledge. Ham radio operators are very good at helping each other, as well as helping the common man who's not a ham, the unwashed common man who's not a ham radio operator. When they get in trouble with something like the Avianca air crash or a 9/11 situation, hams will come forward and try to help, even though they're not hams that they're helping, but they particularly will help their compatriots, their kindred spirits, what I'm looking for, their colleagues. So that's what we're doing here. That's what we're attempting to do. But don't be embarrassed because you've got a question that you think is a little bit dumb. Hidden in that is going to be some question that somebody else wants the answer to. And when you get down to the basic level of what is electronics, you'd be amazed how much is not known. Are those electrons hopping from molecule to molecule when they slow down that copper? It appears that's happening. No one's ever seen it in an electron microscope. You've got various experiential evidences of it. But when it comes to radio propagation, you would think after 100 and some odd years, 120, 150, whatever it is, you would think we've got it pinned down. And so, experientially, we do. I know there's a 10-watt transmitter from Apollo 15 transmitter sitting on the moon from the lunar module or the lunar rover car. It's going to experience maybe the number is 150 dB of loss between the moon and a 250,000 miles between there and the Earth. And depending on what gain of the antenna I use down here on Earth, I can predict for you within a couple of dB, and maybe even a fraction of a dB, how strong the signal I'm going to get. Depending on the bandwidth and the method of modulation, I can tell you how far that signal is above threshold. I can give you a rough prediction, and even maybe a pretty good prediction, of the signal-to-noise ratio. I'll bet astronauts that'll come out of my loudspeaker in Farmingdale, Long Island, when I did that experiment on Apollo 15 and 16. So experientially, calculation-wise, I can tell you what's going to happen. But now you dig down to the nitty-gritty, and I can tell you that the hardest vacuum that I know of is in that free space between Earth and Moon. I know that that transmitter on the Moon at 10 watts was turned on. I know a radio wave was emitted. We can call it corpuscles, we can say it went through the ether, we can say it was photons, we can say it was power flux density, we can talk about volts per meter, we get all these great terms. We can call it a virus. Something of the energy left that antenna on the moon, came down to my 12-foot diameter parabolic dish in Farmingdale, in front of the Microwave Instruments Division of AIL, as it was then called, came into my feed horn that was made out of a Scottish oatmeal can and an American paint can, soldered together, went into a $5,000 AIL parametric amplifier to boost up the signal, then went into a homebrew converter through a spectrum analyzer as a down converter, into a Drake 2B receiver out of a FM demodulator connected to the IF strip, and there was astronaut audio. And at the end of that was a loudspeaker and a tape recorder, and I recorded it. What really moved through space? Nobody's got a good answer for that. Before the transmitter was turned on, there was nothing in that space between Earth and Moon but hard vacuum. During the transmission, not a single electron flowed through that space. We say a wave flowed. We say photons flowed. Sounds good. No one's ever seen one. We can measure it experientially. I can predict its strength for you, but I don't know what it is. I'm still baffled by what took place in 1971 when I did that experiment. Here I am, what, 38, 36 years later. It was a fun experiment. I can dream about it. I can picture the people involved. I can see the picture of what we did in the June issue 1972 QST magazine. Houston, this is Apollo is the name of the article. To this day, I ain't sure what the heck happened. What moved through that hard vacuum. A wave. Okay? When you find out, let me know what moved. Just because we gave it a name doesn't mean we know what it is. When the doctor says you've got a virus, he knows you've got some kind of a disease, you've got some kind of a malady. He can't see it under a microscope. He can see the symptoms, he can make a guess. What is it? And by the way, is the virus life? We can argue about that. Is it a living thing that invaded your body? So, we give it a name. That doesn't mean you understand it. I think Einstein's got a couple of quotes on that one. If anybody can shed some better light on this one, pun intended, give me a couple of words right now. KQRIW listening. And that's about as much as I know. That person was accurate. Okay.
N2RSO is the metal.
N2RSO. Start with your name, sir.
Okay, Dick. The name is Frank. And I was just wondering if you and Mel and members of the Met tonight are aware of a seminar coming up at the Telephonics Corporation on May 30th at 6:30 p.m. It's titled The Life of James Clerk Maxwell. The lecture is going to be given by Dr. James Proutio, if I pronounce that correctly, up at Juliet Kilo, who is an IEEE distinguished lecturer. If you already know about it, great. If you want more info, I think that would be announced.
My guess is, let's see, I've signed up for quite a few of these lectures, although I haven't signed up that far ahead of time. If I go to the IEEE calendar of Long Island events, I'm almost positive that'll be there. Since it's May 30th, which is a little more than a month away, month and a day, most likely that calendar will say the information for registering will be given at a later time. And I know that I've been to quite a few of these very good lectures at IEEE, given by the IEEE at the nice lecture hall you've got in the basement of the Farmingdale division of Telephonics Corporation. And I know there's limited space, so therefore we have to sign up ahead of time. So if I go to the Long Island calendar, I presume I'll see a little bit of a blurb on this one. Is that true, Frank?
Yes, that's correct, Dick. Matter of fact, according to the flyer that was sent to me by Jim Colati, who's chair of the Long Island section of the IEEE Microwave Theory and Technique Society, the registration is available now at the IEEE.li website. So I passed that on.
It sure does, Frank. By the way, Frank, your particular transmitter is a little bit low on audio. Either you've got to speak closer to the mic or you've got to find the gain control on that rig and turn it up. Now, why don't you talk a little bit louder, maybe because it's late at night and you don't want to wake up your family, that's what I'm hearing. But give me a little bit more audio and see what that rig can really do.
Okay, Dick, I'm a little bit closer to the mic. Yes, I'm trying not to wake up the rest of the family. Okay, that's all I have for now, and I'll be more or less listening out, getting ready to get some shut-eye, so I'll say 7-3, and thanks for all the good information you passed on to us over the years. Have a nice evening in 2 hours, so.
Have you heard, Frank, about that website where you can listen to all of the past TechNet so far of all of 2007 and eventually even before that? I wonder if you've heard about that.
No, I haven't, Dick.
Okay. If you go to www.amateurradio.tv, as if it was dot television, no dot com, no dot org, no dot net. It's www.amateurradio, double R between the two words, so to speak, no punctuation, amateurradio.tv. And you open up various sections of the so-called TechNet section. You will see minute-by-minute breakdown of each TechNet, what was the subject discussed, which reel of the tape you can play back as a streaming audio on your machine. And you will hear your voice on that recording by next Friday when it's all documented and put on that website. Take that. Back to you, Frank.
Okay, very good, Nick. Good to know. I wasn't aware of this. So I made note of it, www.amateurradio.tv.
amateurradio.tv, and we'll check it out first thing in the morning. So have a good evening and 2 hours.
Okay, thank you, Frank, for the information. And so maybe by way of that talk, we'll find out a little bit more. Well, James Clerk Maxwell, beautiful genius of a Scottish mathematician, studied radio wave propagation, Maxwell's equation, mathematically. He was able to predict the EH relationship. By the way, here's a beautiful one. You ask every engineer you know, anybody within the sound of my voice, is the E and the H, which are at right angles to each other on a propagating wave, are they time coincident at the same point in space? In other words, if I have a resonator, an L and a C, in parallel with each other, the energy is jumping back and forth between the coil and the capacitor, and that's how resonance takes place. It's like a ringing bell. 90-some-odd% of all the engineers believe that the radio wave propagating in space is E field energy and H field energy hopping back and forth. Good common sense. Dead wrong. The magic of propagation is that if I choose a point in space and stop time, and I choose a point in space at the instant when the E field is maximum, at that exact same point in space at right angles, the H field is simultaneously maximum. I move ahead a little bit to where the voltage is null, the H field is also null. That's the way that wave propagates in space. Opposite of common sense. Even more difficult to explain. And E crossed H gives you a pointing vector, and it tells you the signal is moving from north to south. And reverse E, or reverse H, and it propagates from, not north to south, south to north. I think we've been here long enough. So I'm going to say 73. Mel, let's assume that you can come through very nicely. And why don't you put in your 73? I think we've got a good night. I think we're going to quit while we're ahead. K2KEY. The other person of the tech head.